Welcome to College Land, the podcast featuring untold stories from higher education. I'm Nan Enstead in Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm Lisa Levenstein in Greensboro, North Carolina. We're here to explore life inside our nation's colleges and universities and to track some of the major changes that are happening.
We do this by sharing stories about the people who work there. This week on campus, we're going to really dig into the topic of food insecurity and basic needs insecurity on campus. This is such an important issue, and it's one that people don't often know about.
I know, Nan. Around 2 years ago, when I first learned that my university had opened a food bank on our campus, I remember just thinking, oh my gosh, I can't, you know, what is going on? At the same time that I realized, this is such a crucial need. This is great that we're doing this, right? And it turns out that actually we weren't alone. Today, more than 700 college campuses have food pantries, and that's up from 88 in 2012, according to the College and University Food Bank Alliance. Now, just the fact that there even is such a thing called the College and University Food Bank Alliance really tells you something. And you know, it's not just students who are food insecure. And we've started to talk a little bit on College Land about how more and more jobs on campuses aren't paying a living wage or providing people with benefits. And we can see the results of that when we start to look at the growing numbers of instructional staff who are experiencing food insecurity and not being able to meet other basic needs. There was a study conducted by the Hope Center at Temple University, and they surveyed nearly 550 instructional staff and faculty members and part-time instructors from four community colleges and one university in the fall of 2019. And the results are really quite striking. 38% had experienced some form of basic needs insecurity over the past year. 17% had experienced food insecurity in the past 30 days, and a third of them had experienced housing insecurity in the previous year. And educators of color, LGBT educators, younger educators, part-time people, they all had disproportionately high rates of food and housing insecurity.
Those statistics are really shocking, but the ones with students are even more disturbing. The Hope Center also did yearly surveys from 2015 to 2019 about the rate of basic needs insecurity among college students. The composite results are drawn from over 330,000 students attending 411 colleges and universities. So in those 5 years, the rates of food insecurity among students at two-year institutions were as high as 56% and as high as 42% at four-year institutions. The rates of housing insecurity were also really high, up to 60% at two-year institutions and 48% at four-year institutions. And there were also really high rates of homelessness among students, and how students actually go to school when they're homeless is a bit beyond me. The Hope Center estimates that at least 6 million students are delayed or deterred on their path to a degree because they don't have a safe and stable place to live or enough nutritious food to eat. And just like your stats with instructors, Lisa, there are racial and ethnic disparities. It's a really big problem. And to make sense of it, we invited Paula Umania of the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice to talk with us. The Hope Center is housed at Temple University in Philadelphia and is an action research center, which means that it gathers data on students and assists colleges around the country in responding to basic needs insecurity. Paula is the Director of Institutional Transformation at the Hope Center. Before this, she worked directly with students in her 6 years at the Community College of Philadelphia, where she established and directed the Single Stop Anti-Poverty Multi-Service Program. Paula holds a Master of Education degree from Temple University and is a native of Bogota, Colombia, where she obtained a Bachelor of Science degree in Dietetics from the Pontificia Universidad Javeriana. Let's listen. I'm so excited to welcome Paula Umania to College Land today to talk about the Hope Center and the topic of food insecurity on campus. Paula, welcome to College Land.
Nan, thank you so much. It is such a true pleasure to be in this space with you. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Well, I was thinking that we might just start by talking a little bit about what the issue of food insecurity on campus is, because for a lot of people, this comes as a big surprise that so many students on campus are hungry.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, the issue of food insecurity is not an issue that is only specific to the kids who just graduated from high school. And we need to also look at other aspects of what affects these students. So, for example, if you think of who pays for the majority of the cost of going to a college, things have shifted throughout the years.
Yeah, when I went to college, I could pay most of my tuition through the jobs that I worked while going to college. Not all of it, but I didn't come out of college horribly in debt. And I feel like students today are being so cheated.
You know, the family contribution is not the same. The safety nets are not the same. So you have, at the end of the day, the health and well-being of the student not being the same. And so what does that mean in terms of basic needs? Then, because students don't have the jobs, don't have the money, they will not have the capacity to contribute to their education at the level that is expected under the circumstances, they begin to sacrifice different things. I've worked with many, many students throughout many, many years where I saw students skipping meals, skipping rent, skipping utilities to be able to afford a textbook, a code to do the homework, to be able to afford tuition, to be able to afford transportation, to be able to afford childcare so they could have someone watching their kid while they were in class, even if that was online back in the day. So now you have the pandemic, and it is everything that used to happen before exacerbated to the limit, right? We have students unable to secure food because they don't have jobs, because they are struggling to stay afloat with all the demands and all the pressures that the pandemic has imposed, and dealing with things that are critical, like mental health, lack of supports, lack of assistance, right? Difficult systems to navigate, lack of technology, and the list goes on and on and on.
Well, and I think you bring up such an important point, is that we wanted to focus on food insecurity as a really key issue at this particular moment, and an issue that has been of growing importance over the past decade for college students. But it's really connected to all of these other issues, and it affects all of these other issues. And I guess I'll say that here in Wisconsin, I know many students who do fall into the 18 to 22 year old category who are food insecure, who are accessing the campus food pantry. And then there are other students who don't know that there is a campus food pantry, do you know, and who are ordering really fancy clothes online. Like, there's such a difference, such a wide variety of economic situations. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the rise of food banks and food banks being located on college campuses, and the issue that this raises about who is responsible for responding to this problem. How do we address this, and how has it been addressed?
So, to your point about food insecurity, you are right. Right? When people are experiencing food insecurity, it's because they're sacrificing the little money or the money that they have to meet their nutritional needs to spend on housing, right? Because college is expensive, but college, when you get financial aid, you don't get to use that money to pay your rent. You don't get that money to pay for your dorm. You don't get that money to pay for your transportation. So you sacrifice the money that would go for food to meet other needs, right? And so if you think of yourself or your daughter or your neighbor having to meet their nutritional needs, having to meet their food requirements, and depending on a food pantry, you would know that that is not going to meet all the demands, right? Because a food pantry can solve the issue for one day, for one week, for a little bit. It is like mitigating and putting a band-aid. But in the long run, we need systems and we need supports that are more sustainable, that can address the issue, so students don't need to occupy all this time in figuring out how they can address scarcity of food, and they can use that space to learn. That's the goal. And so we have a series at the Hope Center called Beyond the Food Pantry, because we do acknowledge that food pantries are fundamental and they're very important, but they're not the solution. Why they're not the solution? Because it's temporary. It doesn't address the systemic issue. And so what can we do? Well, we can create funding, we can advocate, we can do a million things, but we need to come together as a community. And a college and a university can do better work if they rely on their external partners and on bringing the supports together so students can have easy access. Right now, for example, we have seen that during the pandemic, we ran a survey, and this is at the highest of the pandemic, right? When, well, not at the highest right now, but at the highest in the spring 2020. And what we learned during that time is that students, for example, didn't ask for emergency aid, right? Because they did not know how to apply or if they were eligible or where it was, right?
Yes.
We also know that students didn't apply for food stamps because they thought exactly the same reasons, right? They didn't know how to, they didn't know that they were eligible. So unemployment was another example. So these systems have been in place to provide the support to Americans who need it at a time of need. And students have so many things on their plate. They're overwhelmed with information, responsibilities, obligations, and they're so stressed out. I mean, you probably have read multiple articles where...
Well, I don't have to read the articles. They're in my classes. They're so stressed out.
And what do they
do? Oh my goodness.
They disengage, right? It's hard to engage them. It's hard to get their attention. And it's not because they don't want to pay attention or because you're boring or because the content is not relevant. It's because their brain is occupied by this big worry of, what am I going to do to survive? And it's natural, it's normal, it's part of how we as a species move forward. Yeah. And when you threaten that, you know, you cannot demand that students focus their attention in giving their assignments on time and giving their 100% because they're worried about how to meet their basic needs. They cannot sleep. Right? Scarcity not only makes you unable to prioritize, make you unable to focus and decreases your IQ, right? You don't sleep, you are irritable, right? And so put that into motion, and then you can understand why your students, you know, are probably facing all the challenges.
Yep, they are. They're facing, and I do feel like the pandemic has been a wake-up call for universities to something that I know the Hope Center has been saying for a number of years now, right, is that universities need to respond to students as whole people and as people first. And yeah, so I'm very compelled by what you said, that the university really needs to think about coming together as a community and drawing on its community partners. Could you say a little bit more about your vision for that? How should universities be responding to help students?
So it's interesting, because to say that colleges need to do all this work at a time of crisis is a little bit unrealistic. I have seen multiple colleges around the nation, I've worked at one of them actually, come together with people who know how to do these social services business in a very good way. They are experts, they know what to do. They're nonprofit organizations, government agencies, the public sector, and so on and so forth. They come together and they partner with colleges and they help students get the supports they need. For example, now we have the new SNAP changes. SNAP is what we used to know as food stamps. Well, in December, we got legislation that allows students, more students, get food stamps. So new eligibility criteria passed. So students with zero EFC can get food stamps. Students doing work study jobs or that get approved or are identified as a work study, they can get food stamps. That brings money to them, to their families, so they can secure then housing and other needs. So I would say that my call to institutions is that besides identifying their zero EFC students to connect them and to make them aware of these new food stamps eligibility, the SNAP eligibility, I would call institutions on providing easy access to help students obtain the documents that they require for these applications so they can be considered for food stamps, that they should train their staff, their faculty, people who are in contact with students, including student workers, student leaders, because everyone in the college and in the university should be literate about this, so students know that this is an opportunity that may not be there forever because this is temporary, but right now is the time to jump on it. And that, you know, we are hoping and working with colleges so they have a hub where you can get assistance connecting with food, housing, technology, and other supports that are going to lower your anxiety, your stress, increase your ability to focus, and increase your likability to complete your degree. Because what we want is that students interested in getting a degree don't have to go through hoops and loops, don't have to sacrifice everything and postpone their dreams, but instead have colleges that support them to reach this goal. So when we talk about having colleges that are student ready, means that colleges should be ready to support their students in this journey by offering and making accessible all these supports.
That's a beautiful vision, and I really appreciate that you're talking about this as a hub of support for students that draws on the available federal aid that's there, but also partners with nonprofits and really creates a community response to this problem, rather than it being thrown upon the students to each try to solve this structural problem on their own. So it's very hopeful, very inspiring about a really difficult topic. I wanted to ask you a little bit, because one of the barriers, it seems, is that those structures aren't actually there at a lot of colleges and universities don't have that kind of hub. They might have a food bank, but they don't have this infrastructure. And then you're also indicating that there's a barrier of knowledge, right? Whether people know about what's available, whether they can access federal funds that are there, whether they know about them and know how to get them. And then there's one more barrier that I wanted to ask you about, and that's the barrier of hiding hunger. As one of our professors at UW, Lydia Cepeda, put it, that students don't really want to reveal that they have basic needs that are being unmet. And do you have insights on how to respond to that? Do you see that problem? Is that a significant problem?
I would say that is not a student problem. I think it's an institutional problem. When students don't talk about their needs, when students don't reach out for help, it's because they don't know that help is available or because they don't think that anyone is going to help them. So instead of, I would challenge anyone who thinks that way to think about what is the language and what is the communication with your students at your institution. What are you telling your students? Are you really normalizing this as part of the conversation that we have with them? Because students are willing to say it when they have channels of communication and they see that there are potential solutions, right? But offering alternatives, connecting students with people, engaging faculty in delivering this message, and creating simple strategies. For example, adding information to the first year experience course or to the student orientation or to the flyers going out, or the communication that the bursar produces, or the communication that financial aid produces. In the syllabus, faculty can add information in the syllabus. If you use Blackboard, You can put information, you can make a course on how to meet your basic needs, and in there you can put resources. You can engage student leaders, right, in student clubs. If you have a nutrition program, get your nutritionist out there to talk about how to do this. If you have a food pantry, tell your food pantry people how they can also lift other supports available for students and make it normal. It's not that only poor students are struggling with these issues, because it's not true, right? Basic needs is not a poverty issue. Basic needs is something normal during the pandemic, even more than ever. So people who did not have these needs or these insecurities before are beginning to understand what happens. I invite your audience to look into a movie. It's a documentary produced by Soledad O'Brien called Hungry to Learn. And Hungry to Learn shows the journey of 5 students and their struggles meeting their basic needs. And they're not unique, right?
That's fantastic.
They don't look,
that's a fantastic recommendation.
Right. Thank they don't you. Look like what everyone yeah. would say, like, oh, the right. it's only the poor people. It's like,
yeah.
Right now, there are many people who are experiencing, and you don't know about them, and they don't say yeah. anything because they don't know how and what is going to be the result, right? They may have this conversation yeah. and they may right. hear, oh, I'm sorry. That's not what they want. They want solutions because they want to complete their degree. And I'm going to tell yeah. you why. And this is, well, you're a faculty member, but students want a degree, not only to have a degree, it's just because they have more chances to have economic mobility with that degree, right? So all of these is like economic access, but economic mobility and our workforce development. So it all translates into progress, into the well-being of our nation, the well-being of our communities, and the well-being of the people that we care.
Yeah. And I love that you, well, I mean, just a couple things that I can't help really wanting to underline is that you're really giving advice now to universities about how to change the culture, how to normalize, how to remove any kind of shame that might be residual that people might be bringing with them. There's a lot of class disparity on campuses. How do we actively intervene in that? And I think that's really powerful. But the second thing that you're saying now also, that this is not for these individuals alone, right? Of course, we want our students to succeed. Otherwise, what are we in business for, right? We want our students to succeed, but we also want to build a strong society as a whole. And that's really powerful. I wanted to ask you, you know, at College Land, we're really interested in showing, this is a terrible pun for this episode, you know, how the sausage is made. And so I wanted to ask you, like, you just said that you used to work at a community college. Now you work at the Hope Center at Temple University. Could you tell us a little bit about your career trajectory and how you found your way into this really important work?
Oh, absolutely. It's kind of like starting from the beginning. So my journey is very unlike other people. But maybe some people in your audience can relate to my journey. I had to reinvent myself because I am an immigrant and a proud citizen. But I came to live in this country and I came with a degree in nutrition and dietetics. And I realized that I really deeply care for social justice matters, right? And I've done a lot of work around capacity building and organizational development, but mostly I've done work around adult learning. And in that journey, I realized that there are many cracks in the systems. So I started looking at what systemic change would look like, right? And I did a lot of work in leadership development to begin to work at different levels with a very ambitious organization that no longer exists. But we started looking at policy, practice, and how affecting change could look like if we change the agenda, if we pushed for issues that would really build and benefit communities, not only agendas. And that is how I ended up working at Community College of Philadelphia. And I was responsible for doing, taking from zero all these basic needs work at Community College of Philadelphia, CCP. And that was a journey that I never anticipated would take me into these national platforms, because doing the work every day with hundreds of students, with thousands of students, was so beautiful. I felt so honored, so gifted that each of these people who came into my office and found in me someone they could trust to help them navigate, translate, do, figure out, right? We walked together with all of them, me and my staff, and I have to say, I couldn't have done it with my staff or my team, the leaders who supported me and that trusted me. We were able to help over 15,000 students access millions of dollars. I think that by the time I left there, there were like $25 million or something in benefits, in money. And these cash and non-cash benefits really made a difference in these students' lives. So I had these student stories and all of these dreams of what could be possible. And I worked tenaciously with faculty, with staff, with other students, and we built an incredible fabric in the institution that, because, you know, divine intervention exists or I don't know what, the Hope Center got this funding to do work at a local level. So we took the work at a Philadelphia-wide level and at a national level. So I get the big, it's so fun to help institutions across the nation, colleges in my local area in Philadelphia, and the leaders to talk about all of this that is possible. And I know it's possible because I did it. It took a lot of work. It took a lot of energy. But we're looking at the Hope Center, at different models that can help institutions help their students in the best way possible.
This is so powerful. And I love that you got your start at a community college where you were hearing student stories day in and day out. And I think that that is one of the things that's really special about working in a university working in a community college, is that you do have access to students, to get to know them, to hear what their lives are really like. And they will tell you if you ask, you know. So I think that that's a really powerful grounding for the work that you're now doing that is so much more institutional oriented and really change oriented in kind of a structural way. Do you have any advice for the student who is having a problem meeting basic needs? What's your advice to the student?
That's such a beautiful question. I think that students need to find someone they trust. And if that is a peer, that means another student, or if that is faculty, or if that is someone at the financial aid office or the library, I would say talk to that person and tell them what you are experiencing and ask if they can point you in any direction. That person at the library, at financial aid, at the bursar's office, at counseling, at the student resource center, at the food pantry, should know who, not what, who is the person who's going to help you and will hold your hand as much as possible so you can succeed in getting the support you need. Right now, you are dealing with a lot of fireballs up in the air, but there are resources and there is help. You just need to make sure that the people who are willing to help know that you need help. Right now, because it's remote, because it's hybrid, it's not that easy. So if there is anything that your faculty or your friend can do, rely on them, because you're not alone. And this is something that is not unique to you. You should not feel embarrassed. You should not feel ashamed. This is happening to a lot of people, and it's okay.
Paula Umanya, we are so happy to have had this time with you. Thank you for this very illuminating conversation, and thank you so much for the really urgent work that you are doing on behalf of our college students.
Nan, thank you so much again for having me over, and good luck in all the classes that you're teaching. Good luck to your students and to your peers. Please stay safe, be healthy, and, you know, good luck in all of this, because it takes a village, and you and I are part of it. So I am thrilled.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Wow, Nan, I really learned a lot from that interview. And I found myself just struggling a lot with this idea of normalizing food insecurity. Because while I understand that that's just incredibly important to do and that we need to reduce stigma, part of me kept saying, I don't want to normalize this. This is outrageous that there are people, so many people in the US and on college campuses who are going hungry.
I agree 100%. We have a really deeply embedded idea of what college is and what college students are about. But as Paula pointed out, college students, especially at two-year institutions, are not traditional age. They're raising kids, they're holding jobs, they're doing all kinds of things. And so we really need to broaden out that idea, and talking about it is the only way that we're going to do that. So I know that there are professors, and Sarah Goldnick-Robb at the Hope Center is one of them, who really advocate putting a basic needs statement on your syllabus, you know, to basically say, look, I know that there are people in this class, you know, very likely that there are people in this class that have basic needs issues, and please feel free to reach out to us. I haven't put one on my syllabus because I'm pretty convinced students don't read my syllabus, but I have started making that announcement in my classes several times, especially during the pandemic.
I actually do put it on my syllabus, so now you're making me realize that I probably should be saying something in class as well, because that's very true about our syllabi have gotten so long with all the various kinds of things we need to write on them that if I was a student, I would also find it pretty daunting to read. I've struggled, though, even just with writing it on the syllabus because, you know, I will admit, I myself have not been to our food pantry. So I'm not quite sure what a student encounters when they go there. I heard somewhere that maybe they're only allowed to go once a week, which doesn't quite seem sufficient. You know, it's the same reason that I sometimes struggle with, I also put a link to our counseling office on my syllabus. And yet then I hear that students call up and they can't get an appointment for 4 months. And, you know, I mean, it's a challenging thing to figure out what our role as professors is. But I do think that what I got from the interview and your conversation is that these things need to be talked about. We need to address them. We need to talk about them as much as we can to make it clear that we understand that this is happening on our campus, that it's not unique. It's not something to feel stigmatized about. It's just kind of horrendous, but it's part of life for many, many people, including many of our students and our colleagues, right? Mm-hmm. And people who are teaching classes for us, people and even some of our staff. So this is very, very critical. And I think that the more we talk about it, the more we put it on the syllabus, the more we write it on our websites, I mean, that just needs to be more ingrained into the fabric of the university, even as I hate the fact that it's true.
Yeah, and I think it really calls upon us to think about, and of course, we're very, very committed to this in college land, is to really think about what is the role of universities in responding to this. I was really struck with how this issue attaches to basically everything on campus. It's not an exceptional issue that we can put over here. We can put in a food pantry and take care of it, right? It connects to student life. It connects to academic performance. It connects to faculty performance and instructor performance and all of these things about how do we form a community that takes care of each other so that everybody can thrive. We have to examine this issue.
And I think it's really interesting to think about how different campus communities are going to experience this in very different ways. So, for example, at many elite institutions, you have huge numbers of people who are paying full freight out of pocket, right? You know, very like a large number of very wealthy students. And to be poor on those campuses and experience food insecurity has its own issues that come with it and its own kind of stigma, even as those institutions are the ones that have enough resources to provide more generously to students who are poor. Whereas a two-year college that is struggling to even pay its staff and its faculty is going to have fewer resources, but a greater number of students proportionately who are in very significant need. And so how to think about these issues kind of campus by campus as well, and think about what can a campus do to address the issues that their students are facing, but also what is the role of a campus to connect students to other resources that are out there.
It's such a great point. This is a function of some huge economic problems that we have in this country. So it also points us back to the issue of what kinds of support the federal government needs to give to college campuses and universities at this time.
It really is encapsulated in Paula's final advice to students when she said, "You're not alone. You can reach out to someone. People are here to help you."
And I believe that that's true. I know that that's true, but I also think that that's a call for something for us to live up to as college campuses and as a society. All right, for our report card today, we're going to stay with somewhat of the same theme. We have reviewed some of the information that's available to students who are trying to navigate paying for tuition, housing, food, and other expenses in 2021.
And we discovered the Campus Hunger Project podcast. And this is a student-run podcast with weekly episodes interviewing people, mostly actually interviewing other students, about food insecurity and about their experiences doing advocacy around food insecurity on campuses really all across the country. And so some of the episodes they've done have explored the stigma that students face accessing campus food banks, food waste on campus, and the way that hunger affects us physically and mentally.
We are just kind of in love with this podcast because we think it's another way to break down stigma. It's a way to build community. It's a way for people to make connections and get information. So we give the Campus Hunger Project podcast an A. The other item that we are grading for our podcast is the blog post, How to Save Money in College. This was published on January 26, 2021. It was written by Anthony O'Neill, and it was published on DaveRamsey.com. Now, this blog post gives a lot of advice to individuals who are college students. It's not directed to parents. It's really directed to living in college. And some of the advice is pretty reasonable. You know, it talks about be careful about how you eat out. And it's, you know, like try not to buy the super expensive coffee. Try to buy the cheaper coffee or make coffee at home. That makes sense. But there are also things that seem almost laughable in relationship to the tuition bills and the things that people are up against today, like use cold water or unplug your appliances when you're not using them, or make sure you don't have dripping faucets. I mean, this is a level of like scrutiny on the individual as though if you took care of these things, you'd be able to pay your $10,000 tuition bill that's due on Friday. Do you know, it doesn't make any sense.
And it's clearly aimed at the stereotypical college student rather than the actual college students that Paula was talking about, right? So, I mean, one of the items says, think about getting a little job like babysitting or dog walking, or if you really need to, maybe you can get a part-time job 10 to 15 hours a week. Well, I mean, so many of my students work 40 hours a week, right? Already, right. And they're still having trouble paying their bills. So this kind of advice to me really just was not taking into account who our students actually are today.
Right. It's ridiculous. It's like feeling hungry, take a cold shower. I mean, it just is so out of line and in a cruel way, right? Because it throws the responsibility back onto the student and it to me, it builds shame. If you can't solve this problem simply by getting a babysitting job, then there's something wrong with you.
Did you notice that the last item was don't take on any debt? I just had to laugh about that, right? How many people can actually afford to go to college without taking out loans of some kinds? It just, again, seems very unrealistic, very kind of blame the victim mentality that is exactly the kind of discourse that the podcast and the work of the Hope Center and so much of the work we've delved into this week is really trying to avoid.
Yeah. And, you know, it's on the DaveRamsey.com website, which is a website, devoted to telling people not to take on debt. And, you know, who wants to have debt? It's sort of a no-brainer, right? I don't know anybody who's like, wow, I'm just going to go out and get in some debt today. That sounds fun. He just tweeted something like, act your wage. Do you know? So in other words, only spend what you make. Well, if it were that easy, then we wouldn't have this problem. But if you have a hungry child, how are you going to act your wage? That makes me want to act my rage.
Well, before you do, it seems like we need to give this blog post a grade. What do you think?
Is there something lower than F?
Well, in my school, we can give a WF, withdraw fail. So maybe that's the best grade for this blog post.
We did want to alert our listeners that SNAP benefits, what used to be called food stamps, have recently been expanded. A new ruling has been passed because of the pandemic that expands the eligibility to include students who either qualify for work study or don't have financial contributions from their parents to their education.
It can be difficult for students to navigate all of this information. So we're going to create a Twitter thread on this that's going to have some tips and places to go on the internet, how to approach your financial aid office. So look at our Twitter at CollegeLandPod for that thread.
We want to encourage any students who might be listening to empower yourself. You deserve to live and thrive.
And as Paula said, there really are so many people who want to help you do that.
And so that's it for today from College Land. If you like what you've heard, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have ideas for us, please send us a message at collegelandpod@gmail.com or on Facebook or Twitter at collegelandpod.
Thanks to our producer, the wonderful Rochelle Wilson, and to Wisconsin Humanities for their support. See you next time on College Land.